The Guardian.
Hello and welcome back to Tech Weekly. This week,
as the TVs went flat and thin, the picture got better and the sound got worse.
I'll be talking to Tom Cullen, the co-founder of the wireless sound system people Sonos, about their new TV sound system called a soundbar. And
hello, I'm Jemima Kish, and this week I'll be talking to entrepreneur and investor Dylan Collins about his new project, Box of Awesome.
So, lots of awesome boxes in this week's edition. But we'll also have our weekly roundup of tech news, including a Guardian exclusive into Riot, a Google for spies, and news that EU budget cuts are threatening universal broadband access here in the UK. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Now, Sonos is a California-based consumer electronics company founded in 2002 by John McFarlane and Tom Cullen. They'd come out of exits from big web companies. They were some of the first people really to realize the potential of the internet. But with Sonos, their unique selling point is the design and manufacture of wireless networked sound systems. Multi-room sound systems that don't use Wi-Fi, but use a built-in mesh network, all their own engineering. And to discuss the technology and talk about their latest product, the TV soundbar, I met up with Tom Cullen to find out some more.
So, you know, a soundbar really have come along quite significantly in the last 5 years as a sound system for your television. As the TVs went flat and thin, the picture got better and the sound got worse. And what a soundbar does is it brings great sound to your television. It makes it a lot easier, for example, to hear what people are saying in the middle of all the smashing and crashing that's going on in, let's say, a movie.
So a lot of people would say that when you're watching an action film of some sort and people are saying things, or when you get to the quiet period of the film or the crashing and bashing, that it gets very difficult to hear the dialogue. Is this something that you've been focusing on with what you're doing here?
You know, we focus on really a mix of things. We want great sound and we want all the music on earth for a music lover. So our soundbar focuses both on making sure you have a great movie experience. You can hear all of the nice sounds that were put into the movie for the soundtrack, but also that you can hear what people are saying. And then when you turn that TV off, pick up your smartphone, pick any song or any internet radio station, put on the soundbar and enjoy great music.
So the idea is that it's a Sonos device, because Sonos, you've made your name with sort of hi-fi quality sound, but also wireless streaming around the house, and also the ability to hook into internet services, streaming services. But here you're also trying to go for the TV market, for people who are, you know, watching the films and so on. How big is the potential market for this sort of soundbar system?
Well, you know, when we think about markets, we think about homes, right? And so we look at a home and we think about all the places that one can listen to music. And the one room that we really weren't bringing the best possible experience to people was the room, the main room with the TV in it. And so what this is really all about is making a simple soundbar that also plays all the music on earth. And you had mentioned, you know, things like wireless and high quality. We think of ourselves as in the wireless hi-fi business. And we do mean hi-fi, like high fidelity, quality done right, but also wireless, so convenient and easy. And how big is it? You know, we can see, when we size the world, we can see 100 million homes out there that have what we think of as a modern music lover, the kind of person who likes to stream. And anyone who's modern also has a nice flat TV, because, well, they've come down in cost and the quality's gone up. And so the same kind of modern person who streams is also going to be the kind of modern person who has a nice TV.
And how many rooms is Sonos equipment in at the moment? You mentioned the 100 million potential. How many rooms are you in at the moment?
Yeah, so we're in about 2.5 million rooms worldwide, and I'll also point out, when I say that 100 million homes, there's probably three or more rooms per home that would make sense for a Sonos system. And so if you looked at it at rooms, there's probably 300 to 500 million room potential, of which we've put music in 2.5 million rooms so far.
The potential for the Sonos system, and the question I've often asked John McFarlane, who's your co-founder, is you're really good at streaming data around the house. You've got your own mesh network, so the Sonos devices connect to each other, and they don't use the sort of the standard Wi-Fi that your computer is on. They have their own mesh network. Why don't you do video?
Well, you know, I think that for us, anyway, as an engineering-oriented company, We feel like the deeper we work on a problem, the better experience we can bring for the consumer. And we think there's a whole bunch of people working very deeply on video that are going to do their best for the consumer, whether it's a Sony or a Google or a Microsoft or a Samsung or an Apple. And for us, we think that if we keep taking that same kind of energy and pouring it into audio, we'll bring a better listening experience. And in a future of all streaming video and all streaming audio, we'd like to think that we could be next to that video stream with a great audio stream, and the combined experience would be wonderful for everybody.
So you're saying you'd rather be complimentary to these video guys rather than combating them?
Yeah, I don't think I'd want to pick a fight with an Apple or a Sony or a Samsung any day soon, for starters. And second of all, I think that, you know, when we invest deeper in audio, we bring a better audio experience that will be truly complimentary to them investing in a better video experience.
Now, you and John McFarlane also had a sort of vision that you were sort of discussing with each other back in 2000 about where music and internet music was going. Just explain a bit more about that for us.
Okay, it's a little bit technical, but when we started this company, we had just helped some of the biggest service providers build out parts of the internet infrastructure. And so we saw that there were a lot of standards coming along, like Linux and like TCP/IP, that was making it possible to really build a whole new way of building experiences in the networked world. And at the same time, you know, a lot of the hardware was becoming much more available and much more commoditized. And we thought, you know, you could combine those two things together to create whole new experiences in much smaller networks than the massive worldwide internet, meaning networks inside of homes. And then we picked music as the application that we wanted to build on it, because we were the kind of guys who bought a nice stereo when we got our first job, and we bought a better one when we got our better job. And so we actually built something that we wanted. But that bigger trend that we saw, you're now seeing play out in a variety of areas. You know, there's companies doing, like Nest, doing a networked thermostat, right? Who would have thought of that back then? But it's actually on the same exact trend. They're using the open standards and the lower cost components to make new experiences in the home around home control, just like we are around home entertainment.
And when it comes to music, you had a vision about where music was going. Rather than being individual tracks, you saw it more as streaming. Why is that?
Yeah, you know, the streaming, you could start to see the beginnings of streaming in 2000. And when we sat around and thought about what a future looked like 10 years away, we thought that, you know, in a world where music is like oxygen, it's everywhere, and where people speak many languages, that there would be many kinds of streams for many kinds of music for many kinds of cultures, and that all of those people would want access to that as they got the network from wherever they were to wherever they were. And so we thought there were going to be thousands and thousands of services streaming thousands of types and languages and genres of music, and that therefore a flexible system should be able to play all of that. And in fact, our way of looking at content is, our internal strategy is play all, and we really mean all. If there's a sound on the internet, someday we want to play it.
So you see streaming as being very much the future of where music is going, that eventually you'll just be able to choose from a universe of music somewhere on your system, that you'll be able to, all the services like Spotify and Pandora and Audio and Last.fm and Deezer, these are what, just the start?
I do think so. I think that, you know, there will be some global services, but I also think in tiny countries there will be local services that are unique to them. If you live in a country like Estonia or Kazakhstan, you're going to have your own music there, and it will be streamed too. It'll just be streamed to a much smaller population, but you'll be enjoying the same benefits, because the beauty of the internet with a combination of standards and low cost means that this truly becomes accessible to everyone.
How soon is this going to happen then?
Well, that's a tough one. I've been saying for 10 years that it was going to happen in 5 years, and I guess I'll say now it's going to happen in 5 years.
Tom Cullen of Sonos, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Now it's time for this week's Tech News Roundup with Jason Phipps.
This is the very latest from the best technology news site on the web, guardian.co.uk/technology. Reported this week in a Guardian exclusive, a multinational security firm has secretly developed software capable of tracking people's movements and predicting future behaviour by mining data from social networking websites. The Extreme Scale Analytics system, created by Raytheon, can gather vast amounts of information about users from websites including Facebook, Twitter and Foursquare. Riot, as it's called, or Rapid Information Overlay Technology, remains unsold according to Raytheon, but the Massachusetts-based company have acknowledged that the technology was shared with the US government as part of a joint research and development effort in 2010. Mining from public websites for law enforcement is actually considered legal in most countries, and according to reports published by the US government's Trade Controls Department, this technology has been designated an EAR 99 item under the export regulations, which means it can, quote, be shipped without license to most destinations under most circumstances. It was announced this week that Twitter and American Express are working on a pay-by-tweet system that would let accredited users pay for real or virtual items via the microblogging site. According to the Wall Street Journal, the new service with Amex would let people who link their cards to their Twitter accounts buy products simply by tweeting in response to special offers made over the service, which is over 200 million users worldwide. It would generate an extra lucrative source of revenue for Twitter, which has recently hiked its prices on its promoted trends service to $200,000 a day as it looks towards a potential flotation in 2014. Twitter generated an estimated $350 million in revenues in 2012, and its growth and increasing interest among advertisers seeking to place promoted tweets and trends could double in 2013, according to experts. The service isn't unique to tweeting, though, with American Express also currently working on similar card connection systems to work with Facebook, Microsoft's Xbox Live service, and the location-based site Foursquare. New findings from experts have discovered that thousands of people in the UK are using GPS jammers, which can nullify tracking systems used to detect stolen cars and monitor vehicle use or stop drivers working over long hours. Concerns have been raised around two issues. Firstly, the issue of overtired lorry drivers staying on the roads and defying the presence of monitoring equipment in their vehicles. And secondly, the possible threat that could occur if the vehicles equipped with these jammers were to go close to the vicinity of airports and aircraft that rely on GPS for navigation. Professor Charles Curry of Kronos Technology said, "When people use these, it creates a bubble around their vehicle for about 500 meters that jams any GPS receiver or transmitter. It means that for anyone trying to track the vehicle, it just vanishes off the map, as if it were in an underground car park. Yet despite the risks posed by these devices, which are sold online, it is not illegal to import, sell, buy or possess them in the UK, and it is only a minor offence under the Wireless Telegraphy Act to, quote, knowingly use them. The growing use of jammers could torpedo any future plans to introduce pay-as-you-drive, insurance or road toll systems that were discussed at length last year. To deal with the problem of jammers, the communications regulator Ofcom is looking to close some of the legal loopholes that still exist." Broadband campaigners have said that the EU budget cuts hammered out last week will kill high-speed connections needed by rural homes and businesses after it emerged that the budget for rural broadband, seen as vital for creating new businesses, has been cut by €8.2 billion, £7 billion, to just €1 billion. In 2010, the European Commission announced their ambitious plan, the Connecting Europe Facility, CEF, with the intention of enabling broadband connections of up to 100 megabytes per second for half of Europe's population by 2020. These recent cuts, however, strike a blow to the initiative, which now looks a lot tougher, according to Neelie Kroes, the European Commissioner of Digital Agenda. She said, "This would mean it's up to member states or the private sector to put up the funding, and it's highly unlikely that certain member states would be able to. Just €1 billion isn't going to be enough," she said. "Our 2020 fast broadband targets, agreed by everybody, may be harder to reach, but I am not giving up on them." Broadband campaigners aren't too disheartened yet, however, after warning that unrest among MEPs over the cuts to infrastructure spending could lead to some of the cuts being reversed when the budget comes to a vote in March or April. For these stories and so much more, just go to the best technology website on the web, guardian.co.uk/technology. Coming up next, The Guardian's digital correspondent Jemima Kish talks to the Irish tech entrepreneur Dylan Collins about his new project, The Awesome Box.
This week on The Guardian Audio Edition, from the Arab Spring to global revolution, where the protest movement is here to stay. The love of the chase. Are we hardwired to love running? And in our audiobook review, we look at dystopian science fiction from Hugh Howey in Wool and explore Charles Arthur's view of real-world technology in Digital Wars. To subscribe for free to the Guardian audio edition, go to audible.co.uk/Guardian. Or find us on SoundCloud and iTunes. The Guardian audio edition, a new way to get the whole picture.
I'm Jemima Kish, and I'm here today with Dylan Collins, entrepreneur, founder of Jolt and Demonware, and most recently investor in Fight My Monster, which is like Moshi for boys. Dylan's got a new project called Box of Awesome. Dylan, tell us what it's all about.
Well, it's an awesome box. Box of Awesome is a marketing and discovery platform for kids. Essentially, what that means is that they can get a free box of curated, awesome stuff, which we send out to them absolutely free. It's as simple as that.
It sounds like a bounty pack for kids. The bounty packs that new mums in hospital get. And that's slightly more invasive, though. You're not going to send out bad stuff.
This is less invasive and more awesome. And you're going to be really sick of that word by the end of this. What it is a collection of really interesting, really cool stuff that we think 13, 14, 15-year-old kids are going to be interested in from the world of games, movies, music, books, collectibles, anything that we think is really genuinely cool and, dare I say it, awesome, is going to be going in that box.
So what kind of age are you targeting and how do you keep the parents on side?
This is aimed at 13 plus. So really we're looking at that 13 to 14 male and female demographic initially in the UK. In terms of making sure that parents are comfortable with it, again, it's a very curated kind of box. So we're choosing what goes in there. We're only working with, you know, reputable brands, be they big ones or small ones. And it's free. So, you know, for parents, this is something that's going to help. For kids, it's something that's going to delight. And for the companies who are in the box, it's really a new way of solving the discovery problem, which is becoming bigger and bigger for everybody.
Well, that's the clever thing, because there's a really valuable sentiment around discovery, isn't there? If you had a new brand in a shop, it would be alongside established brands, and that people would, including kids, would tend to orientate towards the brands that they know, whereas if it's in this box that's all about discovering new stuff, is that kind of the nub of what you're doing?
Yeah, partially. I mean, the reason that Box of Awesome came about was we were having more and more conversations with big brands, small brands, media companies of all shapes and sizes about just how hard it was to communicate with kids. I mean, if you look at any of the app stores, there's just so much noise there. You're literally battling with hundreds of thousands of apps, and it's really, really difficult. So what we wanted to do was to provide something unique that could actually be an experience for the kids, for the brands, be they well-known ones with new products or startup brands that you've never, ever heard before, but you'll like them because they're really, really cool. And we wanted it. It's almost like an evolution of what retail was at one point, but really targeted and really focused.
And what about the balance of stuff you've got in there? I mean, is it going to be Haribo or are you sending them dictionaries? How do you get the balance right?
Somewhere in between. I don't think dictionaries would be so popular. I wonder, do kids even know what dictionaries are anymore?
No, it's all dictionary.com, isn't it?
Yeah, isn't it? It's really about literally striking in between. So we have some books in there, but they're very cool, and there's a lot of zombies involved. We have a music company that shall remain unnamed, which everyone will know and everyone will want. We have two different games companies in there, one from console, one from a more mobile tablet background. And we've got a bunch of other things. There's actually quite a bit of variety across the boxes. So one box is not going to be identical to another box. So we think there'll be a little bit of kind of compare and contrast and trading going on afterwards.
And how has your background in gaming, and particularly with the kind of the social side of Fight My Monster, how has that informed the direction of this?
Well, I think, first of all, it's made me incredibly scared of just how disruptive this new generation of kids is going to be. Because, you know, they're growing up making transactions in some shape or form way younger than we ever did. You know, be it a free transaction or a paid transaction or anything else. I think they're much more demanding about how they want their experiences. And I think, increasingly you need to present them with something that is genuinely a bit unique and genuinely a bit different. Because if you compare the amount of content we were presented with 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, it's magnitudinally less than what kids today are seeing. You know, so this is why, you know, it sounds weird. I mean, my background is generally internet. This is an actual physical product.
Well, this was going to be my next question. That does it say something about how online and digital our lives are, that there's now such a real value behind physical stuff?
Right. And I think, you know, that's one of the things that physical retail got right. You know, I mean, obviously there's less and less of a retail footprint out there with so many chains closing. But the ability to actually hold something in your hand makes it very different from anything that you can touch on screen. So we want to give that experience to kids. They don't get stuff sent through the mail to them very many times a year, if at all. We want to be able to do that and literally put something physically in their hands that they can open and go, wow, this is genuinely awesome. These are really cool things. There's not many of them. They're selected. And it makes an impact.
And what about the finances of it? I mean, sending boxes of stuff is really expensive. So are the companies who are putting the stuff in the box, are they paying you? How does it work?
Short answer, yes. I mean, the for any brand, the value of putting something physically into your potential customer's hand is absolutely immense. It's much more valuable than landing them on a website or even just downloading an app. It's about actual proper engagement and also that actual word of mouth, which is really, really important. So yes, people are paying us. We've also got a couple of pretty interesting distribution deals which bring our costs down fairly significantly. Mm. So yeah, actually the financials are pretty interesting on it.
And it's obviously free to the kids.
It is free to the kids.
Yeah.
Although we've had, because obviously we've been pretty surprised by the demand. I was sort of telling you earlier, I went away and got married last weekend, came back and we'd literally 20,000 kids banging the table looking for these boxes. So there'll always be kind of a scarcity aspect to it. And a lot of kids have been asking, well, can they pay in advance to guarantee their box? So, you know, we'll look at that definitely. But certainly, yes, it will be free for kids, free for parents. And yeah, that's not going to change in the near term.
How do you work out who to send these boxes to? I mean, do you have an amazing database of kids that are very tech savvy? How kind of data driven is the experience that you're giving to people?
Really good question. The answer is reasonably data driven, because obviously at the end of the day, we have to choose which kids get the boxes, because there is a finite number of products that our partner brands can produce for all the boxes. So we're looking at particularly how socially noisy they are. We're looking at, to a degree, what part of the country that they're in. We haven't got a precise algorithm that we're saying, right, this is the final one for actually choosing who gets a box. But we do want to give boxes to kids who are definitely going to show them to their friends, because it really is about kind of the compare and the contrast and sort of spreading the word about what's in there. That's really the value of what we're bringing to the table. So we are looking for kids who are naturally noisy and who will genuinely get value out of it. And also, interestingly, those who come from multi-child families, because you find with games as well, that there's a huge amount of both passing on and copying that goes on amongst brothers and sisters. So we're looking at dynamics like that as well. So it's we're not, you know, we're diving into the data. We're not going too deep just yet. But it's a really interesting avenue to look at, particularly as this is a generation that is unlike one we've ever seen before. You know, they've grown up with iOS and tablet and internet since the age of one or two.
Lots of very interesting points of exploration there in working out how you sort of ethically use the information that kids put out publicly. Yeah, I mean, you're talking about social profiles, aren't you?
Yeah, sort of. I mean,
because if you're targeting, then, you know, you gather data about people and then you want to use it intelligently. I mean, it's
you are, but I mean, it's obviously, you know, with their permission, and the feedback loop is very, very clear for them, because of the from the brand's perspective, they're getting direct feedback from the kids about what they actually think about the product, right? And for the kids to guarantee their next free box, they've got to complete that survey and that information.
Right, so it's information that you're gathering from kids rather than information that they generally put out on the
web. We're not public data mining or anything like that. This is stuff that's being, that's probably an important point to emphasize.
Yeah.
But it's I mean, I could talk about this for literally hours, but I was having a big argument about whether kids or not actually care about data privacy anymore. And it's a really interesting one, because you know, I've seen data that says actually kids are getting a lot more savvy about what they sign up to, and I've seen completely conflicting data at the same time. So we don't know. And I think what's even more interesting, and I could talk about this for days, is when you see kids starting to build their own software that are actually starting to compete with what, you know, people like me and our team are doing.
I got some research just this morning saying by AVG saying that there's an 11-year-old that had built sort of a nasty bit of script just because he wanted to nick game logins.
Yeah.
So they, you know, they can do it. They're quite savvy, but also in terms of knowing how their data is used, there's probably a role there to have a few sentences of kind of education on. If you tick these boxes,
right,
it means that, you know, X, Y, Z implications. So rather than making the educational or just, you know, informing kids on some other site they're never going to read, mm-hmm. you make it part of the sign-up process that they have to in very clear language.
Right. And I think this also then extends into monetization, you know, because you see, I mean, in terms of in-app purchases, you know, how many disgruntled parents are out there about, you know, oh, my 5-year-old spent $1,000 on Clash of Clans or something like that. And it happens. And I think you're going to see all of the data privacy stuff essentially extend to encompass monetization within kids as well, or certainly under 13s. And again, one of the reasons that we wanted to keep it free was so that there really wasn't any conflict there between parents and kids.
Because there can be an assumption if the service is free that you have to pay in other ways, though.
There can. And you know, we're as transparent as we possibly can be to say, actually, no, it's free as in free. But, you know, I really do think that legislation like COPPA in the US is going to end up extending to get fairly militant, I would say, about monetization amongst kids. Because it's an area that no one has really done much about. And to me, it's arguably a bigger one than data privacy.
And what's next?
More awesomeness. You knew I was going to say that, didn't you? Next month, the first box ships in the last week of February. So kids have between now and then to go and sign up to the list on boxofawesome.tv. And after that, we will then start shipping more boxes. We'll possibly do something specifically for girls, which we have been asked about. And we're also going to be doing something on the digital side as well, as kind of a partner box. Because, you know, it takes a day or two or 3 days for your physical box to arrive. So we want to give people something to do while that's happening. But we're still testing and tweaking. We're pretty early still.
I'm not 13 anymore, but I fancy I might just sign up anyway, just to have a look. Dylan Collins, thank you very much.
Thanks to Jemima there. And remember, if you want to read any more technology news, day or night, just go to guardian.co.uk/technology. Also available on your mobile phone, app, tablet, whatever you want. That's all we have for you this week. The podcast was produced by
me, Jason Phipps. And the music featured in this week's edition is by Hear Hoy from Chile. To hear the tracks in full and download for free, go to his website. That's soundcloud.com/hearhoy. That's HEOREHOI.
But for me, Charles Arthur, and from all of us on the tech team, it's goodbye for now. See you next Thursday.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.